We're going to take a musical break, and we're going to come back and talk about a new book by Mike Rhodes, Dispatches from the War Zone.
Don't come to Fresno if you're homeless, and don't go telling all your friends. Don't you go begging or sleeping in the streets. We don't want that here. Oh, we look down on anyone who makes our town look bad. Don't come to Fresno if you're homeless, and don't you dare bring all your pets. Don't bring your personal belongings if you come. You won't be here long. And don't go pushing shopping carts down on Woodward Park. How much can we take, seeing the world so full of hate? So much suffering and no reason why. I think it's time to occupy. One, two, three, four. If you're homeless, and we don't care if you're a vet, or that you lost your buddies in Iraq and Afghanistan. Quit your whimpering, get a job. To us, you're just a bum. Please come to Fresno if you're wealthy, if you like taking people's home, if you love war and stealing from the poor. Welcome home, my friend. You all come over and help us kick the homeless while they're down.
And that was Patricia Wells and Augustine Lira singing their homeless song about Fresno. I thought that would be a good lead-in to this section of our show. As Pam mentioned, I have just finished a book called Dispatches from the War Zone, and I would like to read a little bit from it so that you get an idea of what the book is like and how this first chapter is about how I became involved with the homeless issue. So here we go. I could hear voices in the back of my print shop in downtown Fresno getting louder. The yelling was coming from the alley, and with the roll-up door open, I could see a homeless man trying to escape the taunting coming from a police officer who was still on his bike. The officer was calling the homeless man a human cockroach, telling him to get a job and that his girlfriend was a whore. When this incident took place in the summer of 2002, I was not a homeless advocate. In fact, I was generally annoyed with having to clean the trash, urine, and human feces from the alley so that customers and delivery people could get to our shop. But I was disturbed by this affront to common decency and soon headed to the alley to see what the hell was going on. The officer was now off of his bike and in the homeless man's face, continuing to insult him. The homeless guy was trying to evade the officer, but he could not get away. Finally, I stepped into the middle of the scene and asked if the homeless guy, his name is Dave Ritter, would like to come in and recycle some paper and aluminum plates. He was more than happy to get out of his current circumstances, which probably was not going to end well. After getting Dave settled into his work, I returned to the alley where Officer Mike Smith was pacing back and forth. The officer stated to me that Dave is a worthless drain on society and that he intended to arrest Dave for an alleged incident that had taken place earlier at the market on Ventura Street and Van Ness Avenue. No doubt the officer expected me to sympathize with his efforts because I was a white, middle-aged business owner who, like many others, was fed up with the homeless. Instead, I asked him for his name and badge number and filed a complaint with Internal Affairs. In the complaint, I wrote, quote, that the behavior exhibited by Officer Smith was unprofessional and demeaning. The officer appeared to be provoking a confrontation, and that police officers have a duty to protect, not harass the public, end of quote. I waited for a response from Internal Affairs and even called them a few times, but I was never informed of an outcome in this case. A year or so later, in an informal setting, I asked Fresno Police Department Chief Jerry Dyer about what had happened. He assured me that the incident had been taken care of, although he did not say exactly how it had been resolved. Although I never found out what, if anything, happened to Officer Smith, I do know that he continued to work with the homeless in downtown Fresno for many years after that incident. At the time this happened, I was the editor of the Community Alliance newspaper, a monthly alternative independent newspaper in Fresno. The paper is the voice of the progressive movement and supports peace, social, and economic justice. My curiosity was aroused by this incident, and I wanted to know more about what was going on with the homeless in downtown Fresno. Dave, who I had not met before the confrontation with Officer Smith, said the police were always harassing the homeless when they were north of Ventura Street in downtown Fresno. South of Ventura Street is the old industrial section of downtown Fresno. There are some warehouses, light manufacturing, and many abandoned buildings in that part of downtown. Not too many Fresnans visit that area or even know it exists. On the other hand, the area north of Ventura Street was being developed with the new Fresno Grizzlies baseball stadium having been built that year. Optimism about downtown Fresno north of Ventura Street was up, and developers and builders did not want the homeless giving potential investors a bad impression. The Poverello House and Rescue Mission, the two largest social service agencies in town that focus on the needs of the homeless, are both located south of Ventura Street, which gave powerful and influential forces an argument for why people like Dave should not be wandering around in the business district of downtown Fresno. The Poverello House was established in 1973 by Mike McGarvin, who started out by giving away food to the poor and homeless. The project grew and today takes up an entire city block where the homeless can receive food, clothing, dental care, live in a tool shed, and sometimes find a pathway out of homelessness. The Poverello House, which will be discussed throughout this book, is not going to end homelessness in Fresno, but it does try to make people's lives a little easier by providing essential services. On the other hand, it has been the moving force behind the destruction of homeless encampments that have emerged in the area around its facility. Spokespersons and staff at the Poverello House often talk to the media about how dangerous and violent the homeless are who live outside on the street. Whatever issues I have with the Poverello House are minor compared to those problems at the Rescue Mission. For years, you would have to attend a religious service to sleep at the Rescue Mission. Now, even that's not enough. If you are not in a recovery program, you can't sleep at the Rescue Mission. In other words, they have more than 100 beds available, but most of them are empty each night because the homeless do not abide by the Rescue Mission's right-wing conservative religious doctrine. The Rescue Mission has even sent its disciples, men enrolled in a program at the Rescue Mission, sometimes ordered to be there by the court, they've sent them into the homeless encampments and destroyed homeless people's property. More about that later. In 2002, friends of mine who work in grassroots groups like Food Not Bombs told me about their experiences in working with the homeless. The Food Not Bombs group operates under the assumption that it does not need government permission to feed the hungry and gives food to anyone who shows up. The Food Not Bombs folks are amazingly committed, showing up on the same day, week after week, sharing what they have with the poor. Food Not Bombs activists such as Dallas Blanchard and Kelly Borkert shared their knowledge and introduced me to more homeless people. There emerged a pattern of stories about homeless people in the downtown area north of Ventura Street being woken up, harassed, and told to move on. Homeless people living south of Ventura Street, as long as they kept themselves out of sight, were largely left alone. My assumption when I started getting involved with this issue was that this was mostly about economic development. The builders and developers had a financial interest to keep the homeless out of parts of downtown where redevelopment was taking place. The elected officials at City Hall were directing the police to push the homeless out of downtown because their presence there was not good for business. The mayor and the city council did that because builders and developers are major contributors to their political campaigns and are a major factor in getting them elected. The homeless had no political power and were therefore being pushed around by forces outside of their control. I was about to find out that it was a lot more complicated than that.
Okay, Mike, thank you for reading out of your new book, Dispatches from the War Zone. And you said you were about to learn something that it was a lot more. Tell us about that. What did you learn?
Right. The story really developed into something I would never have imagined. And I stayed with it for over 10 years, writing about it almost monthly in the Community Alliance newspaper. One of the things that I discovered was that the city of Fresno had a policy of taking and destroying homeless people's property. They would sweep in with their bulldozers and destroy everything in a homeless encampment. And I was just kind of astounded that they did this week after week, and eventually got to the point where I started talking to some attorneys about it, which led to the lawsuit, a class action lawsuit against the city of Fresno that asserted that the city was illegally taking and destroying homeless people's property. And that went to federal court. It was settled out of court for a $2.3 million settlement, which benefited the homeless people and changed public policy so that the city could no longer take and destroy, immediately destroy their property. And the reason that that was important is that the city had one policy for middle class or wealthy people. If their property was lost or left in the city somewhere, say somebody left their bike at a park, a Woodward Park, the city wouldn't come out with a garbage truck, throw it in the back of the garbage truck and immediately crush it. But that was the policy with poor people, and homeless people were losing not only their clothing or their sleeping bags, but they were losing things like their ID. One man lost wedding photos, the only contact he had with family, a directory. One woman lost an urn that had her granddaughter's ashes in it. There were things that were totally irreplaceable, and the city's policy was basically unconstitutional and found so in federal court. So that was one of the things that I found out in this journey.
Okay, and why did you write the book? Why do you think it's important for people to read the book?
Well, I think there's a narrative out there that the city of Fresno, Ashley Swearingen, many government officials and many social service agency officials have put out there that people are homeless because of their shortcomings, it's their own fault, that they have done this to themselves. I think it's important to look at this in a different way. And so what my book does is it talks about not only what city policy has been, but what it could be, and the reasons why there is homelessness, not only in Fresno, but throughout the country, and what we could do about it. The issue that I found, that sort of the big picture here, is that there is simply not enough affordable housing, and the economy is so bad that you're inevitably going to have people who are without housing, given the economic situation and the priorities that this government has had to run society. It is, people are homeless because of economic and social policies that are run by the government. It doesn't have to be that way. Well, and for example, housing, public housing, has been so underfunded for the last 20 years that there's just, the inevitable result is that there's not going to be enough housing for people who have limited incomes. And in a community like Fresno, where the economy is so bad, unemployment is so high, you're going to have people that get pushed out of the market and have no place to live. If we had other priorities, if we prioritized human needs rather than, say, building another bomber or invading another country, we could end homelessness tomorrow in this country. And it's this book is an attempt to give people a large larger view of what's going on and what is at stake. See, I wrote all these articles over a period of 10 or 12 years, and probably nobody read every article to know like what the continuity of it was. When you put it all together in a book form, it presents a different picture than if you just read one article at a time. And I'm hoping that people will come away with enough knowledge from reading this book that they can start addressing some of the issues that need to be addressed in order for us to end homelessness. And I would point to the Eco Gardens. The Dakota Eco Garden is an example of what has come out of people's struggle to have an alternative policy to what the city has offered. The city has offered basically a policy of death and destruction. The Dakota Eco Garden has created an environment that allows homeless people to have a safe and legal place to live, get back on their feet, and live a better life. And I think that that is an important message of this book, is that we can do things better. It's not going to take millions or billions of dollars to do it. The means are there, and if this project, the Dakota Eco Garden, was replicated in, 100 or 200 different places in Fresno, homelessness would be a whole different thing. In fact, it would probably disappear, because people would have a safe, legal place to go, they would get back on their feet, and they would live a better life. So that's one reason why I'm so glad that there are folks here from the Dakota Eco Garden to talk about that project. So I think I'm going to throw it back to you.
Okay. Well, just before we move on, because we do have the folks here from the Dakota Eco Garden, and just before we move on to that, Mike, can you tell our listeners how they can get a hold of your book if they want to?
Well, that's a whole another interesting journey that I've been on, is publishing a book of this nature in Fresno. It's not easy. I mean, there's just very few bookstores out there that can take them and sell them, so a lot of it is done online. And if you want my book, you could look up Dispatches from the War Zone on, you can Google it or whatever other search engine you use. You'll find where it's available, which, you know, one of the places is Amazon. I've sent it a copy to Barnes & Noble, so they're considering having copies of it in their store. There's another bookstore I'm talking to in Clovis called The Book Barn, which I hope they will have it soon. But right now, you're going to either have to run into me, track me down, or go on to Amazon and get a copy. So That's how it's available.
How can people contact you, Mike?
I'll give them my phone number. And if they have, if listeners have ideas where the book can be distributed from, I'd love to hear it. My number is 978-4502. And I'm pretty easy to find. If you just Google my name, Mike Rhodes, on Google, you can get my email address and other contact information.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Our engineer right here at KFCF. His new book, Dispatches from the War Zone. And we're joined in the studio right now by Nancy Waitlow.
Hi.
And Jerry Bill.
Hello.
And one other guest.
Brittany Fanchula.
Okay. And Brittany Fanchula. And you folks are all involved with the Dakota Eco Garden. So, Nancy, why don't you start off and just tell us what it is?
Okay. Hello, everybody. And glad to be here. The Dakota Eco Garden is a 0.6-acre piece of land with a medium-sized house in the front. And it's over 2 years now, amazingly enough. I was involved with the Art Dyson Eco Village group after having witnessed the bulldozing of the encampments. And just really deciding for myself, you see, that something had to be done. So, and we talked a lot, you know. And so I went out and started looking for property, and found this opportunity. At first, it was already in escrow, and I thought, oh, that would have been a good one, you know. And I kept finding ones that weren't quite as good as that. And finally, by golly, it came back on the market, and I brought it to Art Dyson's attention. He is our local architect. Everybody knows him, right? University High School and Woodward Park Library for two things he's done. And Art thought that might just work. We had, it was close to buses. It was right on bus lines. It had little stores, very close, and bigger stores not too far away. And so I proceeded to put the money down. I just had a little bit, being an ex-elementary teacher, retired elementary teacher. Didn't really have a whole lot, but there was enough. And got it started, and by golly, people kind of came along. Some people said, Nancy doesn't know what she's getting herself into. And I'm sure that was extremely true. I didn't know what I was getting myself into. But I think maybe sometimes you just have to do it.
Just leap of faith, huh?
Just do it. And step by step.
Right. And Jerry, you have been involved with this for quite a while.
Yes.
Just tell us what your description of the project.
Right. Okay. Well, let me tell you sort of what we do there. But before I do that, I want to encourage everyone to read Mike's book, because I've been reading it, and it's a wonderful read. And so, thank Mike also for his kind words about Dakota Eco Garden. Okay. Well, what we've been doing for the last 2.5 years or so is taking in people who were basically on the streets, sleeping in their cars, sleeping in parks, wherever, and giving them a place to stay. And we've had, in those 2.5 years, we've had over 30 people come through Dakota Eco Garden now, because it's transitional housing. It's a place for people to stay for a while to get their lives back on track. And we've, at the most we've ever had at one time was 13. Right now I think we have 11. So it's not a huge operation, but you know, we are helping those few people as we are able. And the way it works is most of the people live out in the big backyard in tents, and then beyond that is an organic garden where they can some of them work in the garden, and they can all share in the produce from the garden. So it's now, when I say people live in tents, these are nice tents, meaning what? They're up on platforms, they're all under canopies for extra protection, they've all got solar electricity for lights and fans, and you can charge your cell phone or your laptop or play a radio and so on. and they've all got beds in them, so they aren't like sleeping on the floor or something like that. So they're pretty nice little bedrooms. And then all the services are in the house, a big kitchen, two refrigerators, etc., and two bathrooms plus an outdoor shower, so three showers. So that's where all the services are, and a laundry room and a computer room. Brittany is reminding me. And the computer room is essential because people that are going, doing classes like Brittany did, can do their homework there. And then other people have found jobs through there, including one guy who's gotten a job starting, I think, on the 1st of March, who found that job through those computers. And those are all donated, by the way, by most of them from the Unitarian Church. A little shout out to the Unitarians. So, these things are all connected. So this is how the operation works. And we have, it's all volunteers. Nobody gets paid anything. We do have a volunteer retired nurse who comes around and helps people with their medical needs and gets them to the doctor's office and things like that. A lot of people have medical problems. Some people have mental health issues. So we try to hook them up with therapists. Some people have just all sorts of issues. Some people have addiction issues and they're in recovery and they need a safe place to be. And people stay and they get their lives back on track and they leave, and we have many, many success stories. One of them is here with us in the room today, Brittany Fanciullo. Is that how you say it, Brittany?
Fanciullo.
Fanciullo, she says Fanciullo. I was saying it how it's written. Anyway, Brittany is one of our proudest success stories. Came to us from the streets, started attending City College, got her life back together, now has a place of her own. Let her tell her story.
Yeah, why don't you let Brittany tell her story?
Yeah, go for it, Brittany.
Okay, so I guess I should maybe say how I ended up homeless, because Mike Rhodes had touched on that about the economy, because I graduated from one City College program, and my kid's father had passed away all in 2010. Since then, I looked for a job every day, 8 hours a day for a year. And that's when it all went downhill, and I lost my apartment, and had to send my kids to their grandparents, and a little while after that, I lost my car. So I was out there, in Tent City. I was lucky to barely get out of there right before the bulldozers. I mean, like a week, few days, 2 weeks before the bulldozers came. I was at Evangel Home, but I had a job that was past Clovis Community Hospital and wasn't able to make it past before the 5 o'clock curfew, and I was kicked out. So I was back on the street. And we just happened to call Bev Fitzpatrick and ask her, do you know anyone who would let us pitch a tent in the backyard? And she sent us to the Eco Garden and said they were having an open potluck for the day after Thanksgiving for anyone who was hungry. And we ended up over there and just loved it. And it's been not just stability and security and all that, but it's been a lot more to me. They're the reason why I'm involved in the community now. They are the reason that I have a passion for wanting to help others, and that's why I ended up in school for social work. And I'll be getting one of my certificates this semester, and it's all, I wouldn't have been able to do it without being there.
Describe just a little bit what was it like coming into that and living there?
When I got there, they had barely had a few people. It was kind of in the beginning. And right off the bat, it's a little rough at first with different people. But after a while, we really became close and, learned to work together and learned to, it really helped me to learn how to live in a community with people. And and get along and, like I said, work together. And I still go back there and visit for the ones that are still there.
And what do you think were the mechanisms or the tools that help people figure out how to get along and how to work together?
You kind of do, just to make it more pleasant to live there. You kind of just, you're all put together and you don't know each other from anything, and you're having to, there's no one telling you what to do all day. So you learn how to live that way. I guess what I could say. They did also have Jacqueline Ryle come in and help with conflict resolution, and she even gave us a wonderful book about it that she wrote called All I Want Is a Little Peace. So that also helped when we started getting more residents there. But you just there's work to be done there, and
there were some hard times, I think, during your tenure at the Eco-Garden.
there was.
We've gotten through some hard times, and us that are supposed to be in charge have learned a whole lot, but so have the people that have lived there.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah.
Well, I guess I wonder, we don't have, of course, a lot more time, but I guess the question that leaps to my mind is, I mean, for one thing, we've heard for years is that, as Mike was referring to this narrative, these are people who, have brought this on themselves, and they have these serious, mental health problems and drug addiction problems, and all we can do is just throw our hands up in the air and, it's hopeless. I guess the question that I would have for any of you that want to answer, can you replicate this? Is this something that could it's a wonderful thing that exists in Fresno, but can we have 10, 20, 200 of these here?
Well, I think we could, yes. They wouldn't necessarily all be identical, meaning they might have to specialize in serving certain populations, but people with drug addiction problems can be helped. People with mental health issues can be helped, and people with just physical health issues can be helped. And we can't take everybody at Dakota Eco Garden. There's certain kinds of people that we wouldn't be able to work with in our setting. But if there were, 10, 20, 200 of these, then they probably would specialize, and one place would be able to deal with people with certain kinds of issues.
So, and what would be the finances of it?
Oh, wow. I'm the treasurer. I guess I should answer that. It's all donations. It's all just local, like our radio station here. It's all just donations. It's a tax-exempt organization, and people donate to us, and some churches, including the Unitarian Church and Community United Church of Christ, are regular donors, and Temple Beth Israel has given us a large donation also. So that's how we get by, and we don't have any government grants. We don't have any kind of grants at all. We just do it with donations.
But that's not the way it has to be done for the overall problem.
Yeah, yeah, right. Because if
that's the way this little thing is being done.
Right, right. But I guess my question is,
in the
we do know the government
picture,
has a lot of money.
And they need to use it in this problem.
Right, right. What if they used it?
And the economy needs to be focused on people in the middle and at the bottom, mm-hmm. and the help needs to be there for the mentally ill. That's just so important, and we've had applicants lately, more and more, mm-hmm. who need more help than we can really give them. So, our way of doing it will help some people, but if the economy were better, they would all be in jobs in their own homes, that we wouldn't be needed at all.
Right.
Okay,
right.
So government needs to do emergency housing now. We need to have emergency housing now, and that's number one. And then the safe and legal campground idea. The city's housing people. We're associated with Wings and those guys tell us that they're collecting furniture, donations of furniture for people who are newly housed, and lots of people are, you know, but lots of people aren't.
Yeah,
also, and everybody in this town knows it. They see them, and they want them to be helped.
Right.
We get the ones who fall through the cracks, so to speak, and we do it on a very low budget, kind of demonstrating to the city that you don't have to spend millions and millions to help people.
How, like, describe the budget just really quickly, and then we have to move on.
Our total budget is around $20,000 a year, and we're taking care of maybe 10 to 13 people during that time.
Wow, so it's less than $1,000 per a person to house them.
Exactly.
Yeah. Wow, wow.
People live every day of the waste and decay of the discards of their fellow man. Here in Sub-City, life is hard. We can't receive any government.